Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview with our guest, Raymond Corey. Raymond and I met years ago, probably in 2006. I had to go back and look this back up.
Oh, yeah, when Templar came out.
When Templar came out. And today we're going to be sitting and talking about his new book, Empire of Lies, which is so much fun to see the projection of your career, like, you know, through these years and things like that. So, welcome. I'm going to start with our review last week. From our review, Ray Palin said, Corey has managed to put together a novel that is a brilliant mix of speculative historical fiction with a dash of murder, mystery, crime, and sci-fi thrown in. Is that a good assessment of what happens in the book?
And some cooking.
And some cooking. And something else just to throw in there as well. Just to throw in there as well.
And self-help, but I mean, I downplay that.
You downplay that. Yeah. When you pick genres, we'll put that down. So it's being compared to The Man in High Castle, Fatherland, and Underground Airlines, which is very high praise indeed. So did you see that when you were going in? Did you, like, there's a vision in, you know, for you of what you were going to set out to write?
Well, the story I came up with was an alternate reality story. So it was kind of easier to define. It was one genre. I mean, it was one jump from reality. But it quickly evolved into a story that, particularly because I write thrillers and I felt it was lacking a driver for the suspense. And I came up with the idea of a time traveler who, someone from our world, rather than an alternate history that happens in the past, because of whatever reasons, history, something didn't happen the way it happened in our world. I thought, what if someone from our world went back and made that change? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a time travel and an alternate history, which made it so much bigger. So yeah, from the onset, I thought, this is a huge, huge, huge concept.
It was a huge concept to be able to play with. When you were doing it, did you actually plot and outline it, or did you just start free writing?
I couldn't start writing because it needed a ton of research. I mean, I always research a lot, but this book had way more research for various reasons. I knew nothing about the Ottoman Empire. For me, the interesting thing was, what if Western Europe today had evolved under Islamic rule for the last 300 years? So rather than kind of the political debates about the refugee, the rise in refugees coming from the East, what if actually Western Europe was under Ottoman rule? And the jumping point of this was, I mean, under Islamic rule, the obvious one was for it to be under Ottoman rule, because the Ottoman Empire did survive for 400-500 years.
I didn't realize until I started doing some research after reading the book that it survived till World War I.
Yes.
I had no idea that, I missed that in history class, that the Ottomans were around till after World War I.
From 1450 to 1922. I mean, that's a very, very long-lived empire.
And so you started with the speculative of, like, what if? Mm. So it's what if the world was reshaped? Mm-hmm. And what if the world was really shape-shift? Mm-hmm. Because it would be exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm not as sharp as history. So when you started studying the history and you did the research, how long did you spend on doing that, just learning about what the world was like then?
I'd say the research component of this book was way over a year. I mean, probably closer to 2 years than to 1 year. Because there were various areas I had to research. One was, what is the history of the Ottoman Empire? How was life under? How did they evolve? But then, in thinking about what if it had lasted to today, which might not seem like such a long leap from the end of World War I, 1920 to today, it's 100 years. Actually, I couldn't use the last 300 years of their history, because from around the time of the critical event in the book, which is the siege of Vienna, which the Ottomans besieged Vienna for a whole summer. They bombed it, they dug tunnels and put mines under the walls to bring them down. And they were actually one day away from storming in. So They didn't. It was September 11th, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I remember it was like September 11th, September and they 11th. Didn't do that, and what they did the next
the
day?
The next day, they didn't have time to blow up, because the next day the Christian army rode in, and that was the beginning of the end of the Ottoman Empire.
I wonder so, if it's a tie-in for the September 11th events.
It is.
It is the tie-in.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's, I mean, there's a reason for that date. So yeah. So the from that point on, the Ottoman Empire was being pushed back and back and back to Turkey, and all the and also it was falling backwards compared to the West in terms of the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution. There were political upheavals. Technological upheavals, societal upheavals,
right.
Culture upheavals, whereas they were falling back, and different sultans at different times tried different reforms to try to catch up with the West. So everything that's happened in the Ottoman Empire's last 300 years was actually a poor mirror. They were trying to copy what they were seeing in France and Britain and Germany. And so I couldn't use any of that, because in my book, they took over Europe 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that happens, they are the leaders. They're forging ahead with new concepts. And my big bad, if you like, who goes back in time, in order to make this happen, knows that things like the Enlightenment, things like the rise of nationalist thinking, the rise of the concept of democracy, of overthrowing monarchies, these are all things that are going to threaten a sultan, the things that are going to threaten absolute rule.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows ahead of time that these things need to be diffused. So he's specifically makes things, sets out plans to crush these movements before they ever happen. So yeah. I couldn't just say, well, the Enlightenment happened, but it happened under the Ottomans rather than, no, he didn't want it to happen.
Right. All these things had to be suppressed. All these things couldn't occur,
exactly.
Either that or the
in
rule
order to
happen.
Assure the longevity, the legacy of his achievement, which means that there was not just historical research about what the Ottoman Empire was like, but there was research about all these other events that shaped our world,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and how might they have happened under, or how might they have been blocked, but what would have come in their place?
Right.
How would technologically, how would you, rather than have the steam engine invented in the UK, how could you bring these guys, how could you lure these guys over and have them be based in Turkey and have them, so it was an amazing.
It is like rethinking every single thing and moving it to another part of the world and
yeah.
having the expertise be there, the landscape be there,
yeah.
everything be there to be able to have it to work.
Yeah.
So when you're in school, did you like studying history?
You know, it's weird, but I don't remember that I did.
Okay.
I really don't.
This is such a deep dive.
I know. Right? It's. I guess it's. You know. It's weird. I was into biology, really, now, which is so.
Maybe you didn't like the way it was created. You wanted to recreate it your way.
And
it would have been a lot happier. You know, there's such a fear of Islam in Western society today. And there's been for centuries. I mean, there's been for a long time of, you know, what's going to go on. Did you literally look to be addressing this when you kind of flipped the world in Empire Wise as well? Were you looking at that too?
So originally that was the trigger for the book. The original trigger was exactly that fear, that fear that is pervasive in many Western countries about where are we heading, and you know, the rise of Sharia laws in some towns and things like that. That was originally part of what I wanted to explore, but actually it evolved into something very different, which is I thought it would be much more interesting to talk about the problems we have in our world today,
mm-hmm.
in our Western world today.
Mm-hmm.
Through this mirror, through this kind of bizarro world. So I was interested in, actually, much more important, because I don't think that that's a real threat to our lives at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very, very minor, you know, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the, I mean, it's a tiny, I think there are much bigger issues. I think worrying
right.
about the crumbling of democracy, worrying about the crumbling of truth,
mm-hmm.
about ethics in politics, about rights, about human rights, about environmental rights. These things are way more important
mm-hmm.
for me
mm-hmm.
than are we going to have, you know, Sharia law in some little mosque somewhere where, you know, it's illegal. And you have to, so the book became about a reflection of our world through this Ottoman world. So you read it and you go, God, this Ottoman world, it's really nasty. The things that happen, actually everything that happens in the book exists in our life.
Right.
You know, it exists in our world right now. Right. But there are things that exist, whether they're here in the US, in Russia, in China, in Turkey, in Israel, in Brazil, in all kinds of countries. I took elements of current events that are, so any law I talk about in the book, you know, law 295, which says that if you do that, you're that's illegal, or, you know, if you insult whatever, you know, you're throwing, that's insane. But that exists.
It's a law. It's a law someplace. And you just put it all together in one place.
Yeah.
And it is really interesting to think if the world had been reshaped, if this didn't happen, if that didn't happen, if we threw the whole world up, like what would... And there are these fears of things, but they're almost unnatural fears because people are people. And they see people as a group instead of as individuals. Mm. Meanwhile, if you sit down with an individual, there's a whole different conversation going on. A couple years ago, right after, more years ago than that, actually, after 9/11, we actually sat down with Bruce Feiler, and he talked about how Abraham is the same in all three religions. And we sat and had this really interesting discussion. I remember HarperCollins put it together, and there was an imam there, there was a minister there, and there was a rabbi. And we had the most interesting conversation that evening about religion, because it was like a level playing field. And we were just talking about through the eyes of this one person. And it was fascinating, because they're different factions, but we were all sitting on common ground.
Really, I mean, for me, the one aspect that I did want to explore through this world, because that was something that is a big issue, if you like, obviously, is the issue of women's rights. Mm-hmm. So in an Ottoman society, even in 2019 Ottoman Europe, women's rights are not going to be anywhere near what they are in our world. So so I looked at how women live in Saudi Arabia, how they live in Iran, you know, what their rights are, and even in Turkey. And I kind of, you know, I played around with that to kind of reach where I imagined. And my main female character, Nesrin, she's a human rights lawyer in Ottoman Paris.
So let's talk about the characters, because you have a great setting, you have a great plot, but characters are really what's driving this book forward, including this one really interesting character we'll get into in a second. But your main characters, tell us a little bit about them, and, you know...
Well, so my main character is Kamal. Kamal is part of the secret police. He's like an FBI agent in the Sultan's FBI. His main job is to stop terrorists. He's an anti-terrorist agent. And because the Ottomans did suffer from terrorism, they fought Islamist extremists coming out of Arabia.
Right, right.
The Sultan was, by virtue of conquering Arabia, he became the caliph, as in the leader of all the Muslims in the world. The population in Saudi Arabia, in the holy cities, thought he was he doesn't speak Arabic. He's never visited. It's like, you know, a pope never visiting
different countries, right?
Jerusalem, which has happened. So anyway, at one point the Sultan did send his Egyptian army to crush Abdul Wahhab. So when we talk about Wahhabist terror, inspiring bin Laden, whatever, that actually the Ottomans were their enemies. So in my book, you know, we're in Islamic Europe, but they have, so I've got, you know, planes being being hijacked and being crashed into the palace of the Sultan in Istanbul. So Kamal's job is to stop
terrorism.
And at the beginning of the book, he's riding high because they managed to stop a group of guys who were going to blow themselves up at the Sultan's daughter's wedding or something like that. So he's suddenly a hero. But while this is happening, and he's got a partner at the bureau who's Taymor, and they have, you know, they have an interesting relationship, which we discover there's a lot of stuff about Taymor that Kamal doesn't know, and vice versa. And Kamal has a brother who's an anesthesiologist, very, very, very respected, accomplished man. And he's his older brother, and called Ramazan. And Ramazan's wife is the human rights lawyer I referred to earlier, Nesrin. Kamal has always been in love with Nisreen, but because it's a world of arranged marriages, and although they played together as kids, when it came time to
arrange
to get married, the older brother got her, and neither of them were able to voice anything against that. So he's lived his life in very respectfully watching the impossible love of his life, having a wonderful family life with her husband and her two kids. Although the unrequited love is from her side as well. Mm-hmm. So those are our main.
That's your cast of characters.
That's our main.
Start.
Yeah, those are the people we're. And then into this world comes this mysterious tattooed man,
mm-hmm.
who's someone who has an interesting military background. He's from our world. And he was part of Saddam's military intelligence inner circle. So he's a guy who's very well educated. He understands history. He understands politics. He's not necessarily religious, mm-hmm. because a lot of Saddam's, including Saddam himself, they were not
religious people. No,
no, they were secular. Right. You know, it was a dictatorship.
They were zealots.
But this is what really happened when these guys were, after the Iraq was invaded and these guys were either killed or captured and thrown in prison in Iraq, they were thrown in prison with their mortal enemies, mm-hmm. who were the Islamists.
Mm.
And in prison, this is history, this is our history, it's in prison that they met and they realized that although they hated each other, they had a common enemy they hated even more, which was America and the West.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these secular Ba'athist, Saddamist military men, and you have the Islamist extremists thrown together in prison, and that's where ISIS is born.
Wow.
And this is what really happened in history.
It really happened, yeah.
So my guy, it's not that he gets turned into an Islamist extremist, but he's angry. He's lost his family, mm-hmm. through the bombings. He's angry at the West. And when he comes out, because they were, either they escaped or they were freed from prison, because there were too many of them to keep, there was no point in keeping them. He goes on a bit of a vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
And when he figures out,
you can twist things.
The big twist in the book. He decides he's going to use it to change the world to get his revenge.
To suit his revenge.
Yeah.
It was interesting. During there was a book called The Photographer, brilliant graphic novel that came out a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago at this point, and it was really about this photographer who traveled with Doctors Without Borders in Afghanistan, and one of the doctors, when they came back, went to Washington and met and said, I just want you to know there's this guy that we're funding over there, we're bringing guns, his name's Osama bin Laden, and he is not a friend of the country.
Yeah.
And you don't see it, and you are giving him guns, and you are giving him whatever, but he were being played. And it was really interesting that this, after 9/11, this comes out, that this woman had gone and said, I'm looking in his eyes, and it's not what we want to be seeing back and forth. It was very, very interesting. So do you... when I was looking at the tattoo man, because he has he has a number of clues that are hidden on him. So I don't know if you remember that show Prison Break, where they had the tattoos all over his body of how to break out of the prison. And I was thinking of that.
I used to love that show,
especially the first couple of seasons were really
great.
Good. Yeah.
I've forgotten that, but yes, I guess,
I totally remember that he had the tattoos to get out of, try to get his brother out of prison.
Yes.
He'd had tattooed on his body the whole map of how he was going to get it out.
The thing about time travel doesn't exist, so when you create it, you have to create your own set of rules. And for me, there were two big rules that I established. Like, this is my version of it. One is, it's been used before. I mean, you've seen it in Terminator. We've all seen Arnold Schwarzenegger land somewhere butt naked.
Right, exactly. And he runs butt naked.
Because you can't take anything physical with you.
Right.
Because if you can, then you can take anything. You can take weapons. You can take a laptop. You can take, all the information you need in that world. You can take, or whatever weapon you want to take with you. So if you can't take anything physical with you, then any knowledge you want to take with you, the only way, you're either going to memorize it, but we're talking about the guy who's going back to change history.
Right.
There's a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to also technological stuff, how to, steam engines and dynamite. And so he has it all tattooed. And I debated whether or not ink on the skin, well, within the skin, whether that would work or not. Like, is that a cheat, or can we say that ink, once it's in your skin, is not a foreign matter? Does it become, can we consider it organic so it'll travel with him, or will he land and the tattoos are gone? So I went with the tattoos stay. So that's the only thing that you take. That was one rule. So the other rule is that you cannot jump to anywhere where you already exist.
Oh, okay.
Because for me, that was always hokey. Like I remember in Back to the Future, where Marty comes back and he's watching himself running around with Doc, or trying to stop Doc from getting shot by the Libyan guys in that movie. So I was like, how can they both coexist? It just doesn't make. So I thought, okay, and my rule is you cannot jump to anywhere where you physically exist. You can jump to the future because you're not physically there. Mm-hmm. You can jump to before you were born, mm-hmm. but you can't jump back to within your lifetime, which has huge story ramifications.
Because if certain things can't happen, you can't change. You can't change what you know.
Exactly.
You can only change different things that you really have to give more thought to.
Exactly.
You include an epigraph in the beginning, quote from Napoleon Bonaparte, noting, history is nothing but the lies that are no longer disputed, which is so true in family history and whatever. It's just, this is what's going on. Mm. Lots of food for thought. Was that quote something you found before you started writing? Or after you were doing this?
No, it was. It was during my research, and something like that comes up, and you immediately think, "Wow!" I mean, this comes to the it speaks to the heart of the story.
Because it's just whatever anybody remembers. It's only you remember through your lens, too. You don't remember through the whole big lens. You only remember from what
you know. It's like history is written by the victors, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the version we know because the people who won suppressed everything else and kept what they
and there was nothing
the
ever. Ever good on the other side. There was nothing ever good that they were sitting
Which
and talking about.
Which is kind of
where
the title came from. So I thought Empire of Lies is nicely related to that quote. And it kind of speaks to our world as well, to what's going on in our world.
But it's
right
interesting.
Now.
That's not the title in the UK. The what is it? The
no,
Ottoman
it's the
Secret?
The Ottoman Secret. Right,
in
yeah.
the, and yeah. why did they... What's the,
so
the difference
when I
in
wrote
the two
the
titles?
When I wrote the manuscript, my... and I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to be talking about this, but I call the book Caliphate.
Okay.
Because for me, it's a caliphate, and it's anyway. I love.
I remember
the
you telling me that was the title.
Yeah.
And I know what
and
you're talking
we,
about.
And we
but
have
that's okay.
we have extremely collectible bound manuscripts
of that
caliphate,
okay.
which I may put on eBay sometimes.
I may have an e-copy at some place. Yes.
No, I get you a physical.
I remember you telling me this. Yes, I remember that.
But both my British and my US publishers, who are different publishers, the sales and marketing teams felt that it wasn't a commercial title, a good title.
I didn't call them either. Because I was like, right, I'm not quite understanding. Because sometimes when you see a title, you have to have a vision of what it is. And I wasn't seeing it there.
Well, okay.
So,
but for me, Caliphate was the most popular podcast, one of the most popular podcasts of the last couple of years, is the New York Times Caliphate podcast. Mm-hmm. It has over 2 million downloads. So, and it's been in the news, with
us. Visionary on that.
So they each had their own approach, and the UK wanted to go much more as an airport thriller kind of title to just immediately project
Ottoman Secret. Got it.
Yeah. Whereas I think I much prefer the title we came up with here, which is that it just gives the feeling of a much more. A book with more gravitas, a book that's more about something.
It's built on, the whole world is built on a bunch of lies. Yes. And that's what I was seeing is, I was going back to the Bonaparte quote there, like I was seeing there, it totally ties in. And I was just curious about that. Yeah. So you were born in Beirut, you left there during the Civil War, and you came here to this country and were educated. And then I just love the story that you went back to Beirut to go to school.
7 years.
For 7 years. You decide to go to school. And then there's an uprising and you have to get, kind of like choppered out of there,
With the Marines.
With the Marines. Yeah. You've got to go do that. So after that, you go into the financial world. Mm-hmm. When you were studying, you studied architecture.
I'm an architect, yeah.
And I think that the architecture part of your brain and the organization part of your brain that goes into building a world and building a building comes in. Yeah. And I did not know that about you. I totally missed. Mm. But it comes into because the architecture here is of the world besides just of buildings. Mm. Yet whatever you're describing here is through the eyes of an architect or someone who's studied
because
the buildings are not falling down. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
They're going to come down if somebody hits them, but it's not the same thing. So,
well, I studied architecture because I love it. I was always an artist, and architecture seemed to be like the you know, Lebanon is quite a traditional place. You're either you study to become a doctor, an engineer, a lawyer, or, you know, that's anything else is like it's not serious. So as an artist, to be an architect seemed to be like the best of both worlds. It's a real career, but it's also artistic. And I loved architecture, actually. Right. I really loved architecture. And the idea, the cunning plan there was that the country's being destroyed by the civil war. Mm-hmm. Well, then there's going to be a lot to rebuild. So there might be some good demand for architects.
Good architect, yeah.
Sadly, I graduated and the war kept going for another 15 years.
Yeah, so yeah, like, you were sitting there going, I think I could rebuild this city, but
yeah,
you know what?
The timing wasn't really working.
It wasn't going to work out.
Yeah.
So then you move from there to finance, which is also interesting because a lot of the world is also built on money. Mm. So it's built on buildings and money and worlds and building this up. And then decided to become a screenwriter and a filmmaker. Mm. And actually, you wrote the play or the screenplay for Templar before you even wrote the book. You wrote backwards.
Oh, long before.
Long before.
Templar was, the screenplay was 95, 96, and the book came out 10 years later. The book was 2005. Although I wrote the book around 2000 and 2001-ish, something like that, between 2001 and 2003.
So we've got your architecture background, your financial background, and your screenwriting background.
Yeah.
I think it's the reason that you can write with a pace. You can write with something with this thriller kind of a pace to it because you're used to the briskness of the screenwriting, but the other two things factor in so much that if they're not solid, the storyline can't be solid either.
It's true. It's funny. You're the first person to kind of
crystallize that.
Yeah, really. But it makes total sense. I think the finance, the MBA, gives you an understanding of how the world works. Kind of gives you a bigger worldview of the world around you, which is super helpful in this kind of
commodity, world of commodity.
Exercise.
You're building the world of the physical world, but it's also commodity going back and forth. Whether it's the steam engine or whatever, it all had to be all in place.
Or oil, because the reason the Ottoman Empire collapses is that I have an American presence. So in the book, the U.S. is the CRA, not the USA. It's the Christian Republic of America, and it's exclusively Christian and white as a counter reaction to the exclusively Muslim European continent. But what the president does is he realizes that we're reliant on this oil coming out of the Middle East, and this can't go on. Plus, as Christians, we are stewards of this planet. So he orders his industry to come up with green solutions. So they perfect wind energy, solar energy, and it's, they take over the world with that, and the Ottoman Empire suddenly economically collapses because their most important export is suddenly worthless, which I thought would be like really relevant today. It's like, why aren't we doing that?
Well, you think about what's going on in Venezuela, and where Venezuela was the oil capital, and now not, and what's happened to the whole economy there. I mean, people can't turn on the lights there. There's no food. There's no nothing. People have lost like 20 pounds just because there is no food to be had. Yeah. Very, very, very scary times. So when we met with your first book, Last Templar, you and Steve Barry had written books that were both about Templars, and they were coming out at the same time. Mm. And I remember the pub dates were changing.
Yes.
Like they were changing back and forth. And a funny thing was we were running promotions, giveaways of both books, and both publishers were calling us and changing the dates. And we were not sharing what the other one was doing. So with this real crazy, I go on and on. But at that time, also, you became friends with Steve as a result of these two books happening. Yeah. So just share with us, because this is this crazy story that happened 13 years ago of what was happening with these two books.
So here's the thing. As you said, I wrote the screenplay in 95, 96. Mm-hmm. There was a big book deal on offer at the time for this unwritten book based on this story by this guy in London. No one was allowed to see the screenplay. I turned it down because they said, we want you to lose the religion in the book. Mm. Years later, I'm now a successful screenwriter. I start writing the book on the side because my agent nags me for it. And Da Vinci Code comes out halfway while I'm writing the book.
Ooh.
I read it. I'm like, I'm really cutting the story short. It's a long
This is good though.
Nightmare saga. But I did keep on writing it. So I finally finish it. By the time I finish it, because I'm working on TV series at the time, and I'm like, I don't believe this is going to happen. The other publishers, when we submit it, this is in the UK, the publishers who read it love it, but they say, we already have our books in that genre to fill the hunger that Da Vinci Code has created. And the email, from Macmillan, was, and I remember I was telling Steve about this last night, actually. I said, the email was specifically, I love this book. Let me tell you how, to my agent. Let me tell you how much we love this book. We're publishing a book by Steve Barry called The Templar Legacy. Raymond and Steve used the same quote from Pope Leo X. So I was aware of his book from then. My book could not get published. I self-published it. It went to number 3 in the UK.
I did not realize this part of the story.
Yeah,
okay.
It went to number 3 in the UK, okay. On Amazon. Number 3 out of all the books.
Right.
Not out of thrillers with the title, with the word Templar in the title. This was out of all the books they had. It went to number 3. Purely on word of mouth. It was a self-published physical book. There were no e-books at the time. So then publishers around the world go into bidding wars for this thing, and Dutton buys it in the US. Dutton are bringing it out. And as you say, there's like a race because there's this other book, and they're racing it. So we come out maybe 6 weeks before Steve's up there. My first book comes out properly as a proper published book in the US, goes on the New York Times list in its first week. I get an email out of the blue, forwarded from my publishers, from Steve, saying, my name is Steve Barry. I've got a book coming out called The Templar Legacy soon. What an amazing achievement. Your first book. Congratulations. That's a great achievement.
Wow.
So nice.
Wow.
I'm coming from the world of film and TV, which is, you know,
You had a good weekend. Yeah. Now I must kill you.
Yeah. Have this drink. And by the way, the smell of cyanide. No. Don't worry about that. It's nothing. Yeah.
It's nothing there.
The blades in those apples. No. It's
something special just for you.
So I'm stunned by this. So I immediately reply. I'm like, God, thank you so much. It's so kind of you. You know, I hope we can meet up soon, etc. Steve's book comes out. We're both on the list for weeks. We're trading places on the list. It's really fun. We did an interview with Book Report, the Joy Theater. Remember?
Yeah,
I mean, it was a lot of fun.
It
was a lot of fun. And we both did really well with it. This was our, you know, our breakout book kind of for both of us. My first one, and then a year later, Steve and his wife Liz come to London. I take them out to lunch and I say, you know, that email was so nice. Liz tells me, you know, Steve was really, we were all so happy. You know, it was so nice that you replied. I was like, who in their right mind would not reply?
Right.
And she said, you know, you'd be amazed. Steve is a very generous guy. He reaches out to a lot of beginner, you know, first time authors who, you know, to encourage them or congratulate them. And you'd be amazed at how many times. You know, and actually, I mean, the book world I discovered is so much of a delightful world to work in.
It's a club. It's a really good club to be in.
And we all help each other out. Mm-hmm. We give each other, you know.
Nothing like screenwriting.
Exactly. Right. A world of difference. Mm-hmm. And that's been really something. And Steve has been a big anchor in that kind of feeling of after film and TV, it's like, wow, this is actually a nice environment to work at. All the publishers I've worked with, everyone has been so.
Well, it's interesting, too, because on this tour, you've been in the States for a couple of days now, or longer than that. Mm. And as you've been doing events, you did an event with Jim Rollins, you did an event with Steve. Yeah. How much fun is it to connect with other writers and have them interview you as you're at these bookstores?
For me, it's the best time because as a writer, it's such a solitary business. Mm-hmm. I'm alone. I do my own research. I'm literally in my office just, you know, day in, day. I mean, this thing is like a 2-3 year project. So it's solitary.
Right.
You know, you're communicating with people for work, for people in your world.
Yeah.
If you're working on a TV show, there's life around you. There are directors and actors. There are read-throughs. There's you know, you're going on set. Although you're avoiding it because you don't want inevitably the director coming up and going, you know these lines, and then the actors are coming up. You know, can we change?
And are you really going to kill me? Are you going to kill me? Because I've got kids I got to send to school. I really don't want to be killed off.
So to actually come out of my little bat cave and be sitting with James, who I'd never met.
Oh, you hadn't met him?
I'd never met James Rollins.
Oh my gosh, I knew of him from
Steve. So it was so nice to hang out and have dinner. Steve, you know, we've our families have been on holiday together.
Right.
So there's so many more I want to meet. You know, as a few writers very kindly read and blurbed the book.
Yes, you had some fabulous blurbs.
You know, I'd love to meet them in person to thank them and just get to know them because there's, you know, I've been reading them. You know, these are people I read.
Yeah, it's like you're a fan of the genre as much as you are a writer within the genre, and it makes it really fun. Yeah, people always talk about the camaraderie and, like, you know, how much that completely means to them. That's and I think it's such a big deal in this business because so many businesses aren't like that. The other thing too is writing is solitary. A number of people I know have written on shows, like when Megan Abbott was writing on The Deuce. I remember afterwards, I forget who was the writer on the show that said to her, and now you're going to go home and write your book by yourself. And you've been sitting at a writer table. And I remember even George Palakonos, and I'm trying to remember who the other author was, somebody else that said they were working on a big show, and it was somebody was the general contractor, and everybody else was, they were working on The Wire, and somebody just paints the trim, and somebody just does the window trim, and somebody just does this. You had your specific roles.
They're the little
roles.
Subcontractors to the, overall building.
Right. Yeah. There's one author I know who writes great chase scenes, and he's hired just to write the chase, like just because you do a really good job of that. Whereas when you're doing your book, you're doing the chase, you're doing the setup scene, you're doing the fight scene, you're doing everything yourself,
but also you're doing it your way.
Yes,
don't have to. You don't have to have any kind of massaging of maybe we could do this. Well, let's talk about. Although you know instinctively, it's not the way you'd like to go, but you have to engage and politically just keep, you know.
Keep trying. Even if you're going to paint yourself into a corner, you almost have to paint yourself in the corner to get out and get the book going in a different direction and going a different way.
What I really want to do with this now is to get it done as a TV show.
Well, that'd be great. So, you know, with streaming being so big these days, it's a completely different world from when you were writing back in 2006. I mean, it's the quality of streaming that is out there right now.
We're in a golden age of TV.
We really are.
And I'm a big fan. I mean, I watch so much stuff. Might as well be writing some of it. But yeah, so I see this as 10 episodes, 8 episodes, 10 episodes of a, and book 2 would be season 2.
And they all come out the same week, so somebody could just sit there and watch it at the same time, which is the beauty of, you know, a lot of this is just sitting down and watching. Where Linwood Barclay said, he remember meeting me and we were talking about 24, and he goes, this is a woman who can waste as much time as I do. We're having a whole conversation about Jack Bauer. But even like, you know, the prison break things, these like these little kind of references, but it's a lot of pop culture is infusing what's going on in so much of the marketplace right now. But streaming is, you know, people are sitting down on a weekend, and it's more like, I'm still trying to find what's good. Like, I reach out to friends of what should I be watching? Because some of the stuff that's really popular, it's not resonating with me. It's just, it's not catching me. But then there's other stuff that I'm finding that's amazing.
Peaky Blinders.
Okay. Peaky Blinders. That's
what. But, you know, I mean, I think TV nowadays is, I mean, it's right, you know, I read this all the time, that it is the leading art form in terms of our cultural world at the moment. TV is where it's at. It's more influential than books, perhaps, than
I don't go to the movies. I don't go. I mean, they're always at the wrong times.
I'll go see Avengers Endgame because I want to see that on the big screen. But otherwise, you know, when you're watching a show, a 10-hour show, you're so engaged. I mean, the characters, the world is so much more, so much richer than you can possibly get away with in 2 hours, which is why the Avengers story is actually 22 across 22 movies.
Right, it's going to be a much bigger story to tell.
It's a streaming movie.
The Bosch series always drops in April. And my husband always goes to the track, and he instructs BMW instructors. And so he goes to the track, and I'm never disappointed when he goes that weekend because I just sit and watch the whole thing.
I love
and he says, you weren't upset when I left this weekend. And I was like, because I just sat and streamed the whole time.
I'm a big fan.
Big fan of that. Well, this is always has been a pleasure. You have to come back more often because we always have a good time. And I can't believe I had to really go back and look and see it was 2006 because I remember corresponding, doing the interview questions with you back then. So it's always a pleasure. So please come back soon.
Thank you.
Quicker.
Yes.
And if there's a TV thing, like I'd really like to be at the premiere. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you so much for everything all over the years.
It's been so much fun. Such a pleasure. Yeah. Thanks to all our viewers and our listeners, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Empire of Lies by Raymond Corey, narrated by Raphael Corkhill, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Macmillan Audio. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Empire of Lies, read by Raphael Corkhill.
The dizzy, lightheaded feeling was vaguely familiar. Although Ayman Rashid had done it before, the last time had been years ago. And the sensation was so bizarre, so intense, so overwhelming, that after each trip, he had wondered if anyone ever got used to it. Not that he imagined many others knew about it, let alone had experienced it. There had to be some others, though, surely. After all, it had been out there for centuries, millennia even. But if so, where were they? Or rather, when? He had no way of knowing, and had long since learned to avoid speculating about it. It only led down a bottomless rabbit hole of questions and infinite possibilities. This time, though, the sensations were far more intense for the simple reason that Ayman Rashid wasn't in good shape. In fact, he knew he was barely clinging to life, which was why he had had to make the jump as quickly as possible. As his eyes struggled to adjust to the faint light of the street lamps on the bridge looming over him, he felt the dizziness return. He muttered a curse and spat out some blood before huddling down and scanning his surroundings, alert to any potential threat, the cool air floating up from the river cutting a bone-deep chill into his naked body. For that was how he always arrived after a jump, bare-skinned, stripped of any clothing or possessions. The Paris he had arrived in was very different, of course. Beyond what he could see, it was smelly, the air thick with pollutants, a stench that felt more disagreeable, even poisonous, compared with the stink from the lack of modern sewage that he'd grown accustomed to over the last couple of decades. It was noisy, too. That was the one thing that always hit hardest, even at this time of night when the city was mostly asleep. An ambient buzz, a thrum, distant gears and pistons from cars, buses, generators, and all kinds of mechanical contraptions, burrowing almost surreptitiously into one's consciousness from everywhere and nowhere. He had forgotten how noisy that world was. He coughed up more blood and felt a renewed onslaught of dizziness and nausea. This wasn't good. He needed his strength and all of his guile to pull this off and save himself. He shut his eyes for a moment, concentrating on calming his racing heartbeat, willing his senses to fall into step and guard him from any potential threat. He just needed to get to the hospital, just that. The rest would take care of itself. Any other outcome was inconceivable to him. After everything he'd been through, after everything he'd achieved, he couldn't allow it all to come to a pathetic end, here, alone and anonymous, a naked, tattooed corpse curled up in a dark corner on the banks of the Seine.
Thank you for listening to this clip, provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.